This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn. Without further ado, here's Austin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because it's a podcast and we listen to podcasts whenever we do. Today is extra exciting because I'm with Jonathan Hollander, who is the founder, artistic director, and choreographer of Battery Dance. Welcome.
It's so great to be here, Austin. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, before we started the conversation, I mentioned that I'm a classical musician, you're a classical musician, and much of what we do in classical music is based on dance forms.
True.
Yet I know nothing about dance.
I think you probably know things that you don't know you know. You know, like there's something innate within us, and actually a lot of Battery Dance Company's work around the world is based on helping people understand that they are a dancer, that there is a dancer within that's never been discovered.
Right, because, okay, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe we don't know the answer, but chicken egg, which came first, music or dance? They are two of the most, and I don't use this as a pejorative, but the most primitive of arts.
That's correct. You know, with the human voice, no props, no instrument is necessary. It's there. And with the body, same thing. So music and dance are inextricably connected and rely on each other, even if there's not a consciousness that that's happening, as in your case with your being a classical musician, but feeling like you don't know dance. You know, India has been an important country to me since the age of 16, when I went and lived in India as an exchange student. And one of the things that I discovered is that in the ancient text of something called the Natya Shastra, on which all of Indian dance forms are based, the classical dance forms, music and dance are not separated into two different disciplines. They're the same. They come from the same wellspring. So I think the Indians have understood something, you know, way back in history that we have kind of forgotten.
And probably Western, we probably had the same, and it's just been at a certain point in time. It's because, like, I know the forms, gavottes and minuets.
And
these
sarabande.
Are all dance, yes. And sarabands. These are all dance forms, and we all played them when we played our Bach and our Purcell and our whoever, you know, our.
It's rhythm. It's rhythm. It's time. It's a way of dividing time.
Right.
Which is what music does. And, you know, if you're a musician, a performer, and you don't have a good sense of rhythm, something's going to be missing from your performance.
So let's go to that. I mean, you are a scholar, a choreographer. You are the knowledge base of dance.
Well, that's a tall order. I'm not sure that I can take that, but okay.
You have a dance company.
If you think so, I'll take it.
You're better than me at this, so let's do it. I'm just gonna where that wellspring. Where is it? Ceremonial? Is it religious? Is it sexual? Where is
it's
this innate movement?
It's all of those things. You know, my story is a little bit interesting and I think may play into this for you, that I did all of the art forms in a sense in terms of study before I studied dance. Dance was part of my life. I did folk dancing, square dancing as a child. I was in musical theater, so you have to dance. But I was not in a formula dance class until I was 18, whereas I had been studying classical piano since the age of 5. I was in theatrical productions from the age of 6, you know, and visual arts, which is where I thought I was going in my life at age 18.
Really?
Yeah. Sculpture, painting, graphics, all of that I loved. And I thought that was going to be it. And then it wasn't it. And it turned out that dance was the thing that brought everything together. You know, there's something interesting about the choice of careers or the direction that one goes in, that you want to find the thing that embraces everything that you love. You don't want to feel like, oh, it's either this or that. And uh-huh. with me, the choice of dance, which was not really a conscious choice, it was something, an impulse, an organic, whatever.
That's the one that
It took it all together. It took everything. I didn't have to give up music. I didn't have to give up visual art, because the bodies on stage become the visual art. Like,
and set design, that's everything. Part. Oh, wow.
Everything was included, so I never had the sense that I was discarding. I was including.
And theater and drama, they're all in there in dance, because there are narratives in dance.
That's right.
Holy,
right.
I was about to expletive there, but we're 5 minutes into this and already mind blown, because I never sat down and thought about this. It is a holistic art, because you can dance, I guess, a cappella, right? From the head with no music.
Yes.
But it's not the same without music.
For me, that's true. And that's something I had to discover over time, because the first dance maker, brilliant, genius dance maker, who brought me to New York and inspired me and like had me turned on and dropped out of college based on an invitation from him to come to New York and study with him, was Merce Cunningham. And
wow.
Merce Cunningham was the person.
For real?
Yeah, for real. So John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, this whole
This
constellation of geniuses that, used aleatory techniques, meaning chance techniques, to put things together. And the chance of John Cage deciding that such and such should happen on Tuesday night at Merce's performance, and the dancers would have never heard that soundscape or music before. So they separated, but I was kind of within that way of thinking and in love with and totally enthralled by everything that they were doing. And I kind of followed in that line for a while until I realized, wait, Jonathan, you are a musician. And not to say that Merce wasn't, because in fact, even though he separated dance from music in that performance sense, he was one of the most musical choreographers you could ever find, in the sense that the rhythmic play of his phrases, of the material that he created, it was very complex. It was never 4/4 or 3/4 only. It was almost like Indian music with this sevens and nines and 13s.
Right, but melding between one another, never sticking. Like, you could play everything, beat it out in five again and again and again, but you're right. Indian music will meld between, there's a seven, a nine, a five, and it doesn't really have a rhyme or reason to it.
Yeah, last year's New York Times review of one of our Battery Dance Festival performances, in which we introduced a great Kathak dancer from Kolkata. Kathak is a North Indian dance form that has elements of both the Mughal culture and the Hindu culture. So it's really a very unique form, in the sense that it blends these cultures that are right now in today's world are being torn apart. But coming back to the New York Times headline, the mathematician of dance. And I thought that was an intriguing concept. And yet so true, because if you hear an Indian music concert, you know that they'll go on these escapades into, Never Neverland,
come back to one,
and you're like, how did they know where the one was?
Well, like jazz, right?
Yeah, yeah.
These guys are seasoned veteran musicians, so they know when you're getting the vibe. Someone's like, the tabla player is like, all right, come on back, right? Or the bassist is like, all right, come on back, right?
But they never left. That's the whole point. In their minds, they kept track. And this is, you go to an incredible jazz concert or Indian music concert, and you marvel at what is going on in their heads. And I don't think they're, like, a good dancer is not counting. Like, a good dancer is mm-hmm. not going one, two, three, four. No, the body has absorbed and metabolized that rhythm. Same with these musicians, except that what they're doing is just so complex that the human mind cannot even embrace it.
So body as instrument.
Yes.
Now we play instruments, and when you play instruments, you know, you get in the groove. But I am
right. It becomes part of your body, an extension of your body.
Right, and I'm clinically white and awkward. So the whole movement thing.
Is there a treatment for that?
I believe it's called soul music.
I'll go with that.
Yeah. So the body as instrument. Explore that, because again, we're going back to either dance or music. Or maybe maybe linked together are the very first arts, right?
I agree, because you didn't need anything else. You right. just did it. There was an impulse, a human impulse that came from the, you know, who knows?
The ether, right?
The beautiful ether.
Or yes, the human soul, like our innate desire to create,
yes,
and to
the
engage.
Caves. I mean,
exactly,
you know.
But dance engages.
And when you think of native dances, like folkloric dances, dances that come from indigenous populations, what do some of those dances look like? They look like the human imitating the movement of animals. Because there was a relationship between the humans and the animals.
Like the Lascaux Caves.
Exactly.
That's what did they paint? They painted their prey and the things that fulfilled them, which was hunting and consuming these animals. So therefore, there was a holiness to that.
Amazing.
So.
And then how about the temple sculptures in Khajuraho, which show every possible way of procreating or having sex, you know.
The next thing that you consume.
It's human.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is a human activity that everyone shares.
We're going to go down the rabbit hole on this, Jonathan, because I don't
even
know.
We'll come back up.
I don't even know where to start. How does, as a choreographer, how does one hone one's body into this instrument of dance? Like,
that's a really good question.
Where do you start?
Well, you know, the thing is, let's talk
Suzuki
about...
Suzuki method?
That's interesting. We don't have a small version of our bodies. I mean, I guess we have a limited version, because, you know, I started dancing so late. 18 is very late to start training the body and pushing it and pulling it and manipulating it for the first time, because I was not an ice skater. I was not a gymnast. I didn't come into, like some guys who start dance late are already very physical and they have already trained their bodies for something, another reason, but the transition into dance is easier. For me, it was like I was trying to re-sculpt my body, you know, from scratch at age 18. And that was really hard. And I got to a certain level, and then I realized I hit the wall. I was actually injuring myself by pushing myself too hard.
Mm.
And so I think for the first time in my life, I realized I can't do that. I'd go to Lincoln Center and see these great dancers. Like in the 1970s, you could buy a $4 student ticket and go to Lincoln Center and start in the fourth ring and come down. And you'd see Eric Brune and Carla Fracci and Nureyev and Fontaine. And, you know, I'd see these dancers, not even at that level, but even the core dancers were doing things I realized, Jonathan, you can't do it. That was the first time in my life that I heard that inner voice say, that's beyond you. And I was rejecting it. And I was saying, I want to go to a dance monastery. I want to dance every hour of every day in order to, you know, get to this point. And I, as I said, I started having injuries because I was pushing so hard against where the body had already decided to be.
Right. It's like, was it Liszt? No, Schumann. Schumann, he cut the webs between his fingers and he created those weights so he could play piano better.
Was that
and
Schumann?
I think it was Schumann, and then he went crazy, and then his then his wife ended up
Clara Schumann
banging Wagner
or Brahms.
Or Brahms. But Wagner ended up idolizing her, I think.
This is the imperfect history of music. So, you know, we're ready for corrections on every level.
And next we'll do John Cage. Be quiet for the next couple minutes.
And Paul Taylor, who did a performance in, I don't know, the 60s or early 70s, where he sat in a chair and didn't move.
And that was a...
That was something, you know, kind of testing the limits.
Right.
Now, Paul Taylor, I never worked with him, but I idolized him. I loved his work. I still do. I can go and see Taylor 2 or Taylor 1 Company and just be totally mesmerized by the musicality. But I heard from dancers who danced in his company that he did not have music education. It was innate. He always knew the inner threads of what was going on musically. In fact, a person that I got to know and just have great respect for, Gerald Busby, wrote a score. He wrote some scores for Robert Altman's film, like mm-hmm. Three Women, and like some really way out, unique music. And he wrote a score for Paul Taylor called Runes, solo piano, one of the most incredibly compelling, passionate, dramatic pieces for solo piano. And Paul Taylor choreographed a piece that I fell down. I had never seen anything like that. So you don't have to be a trained musician, although, again, a different model would be Balanchine, who was trained as a composer and a musician. He was, you know, so working with the great composers like Stravinsky, Balanchine was a natural. I mean, Stravinsky must have had such a great time collaborating with Balanchine, because they spoke the same language, Russian, but also but also music.
And
I've benefited from that. Just one little sideline.
Yeah,
here,
please.
That I've commissioned a lot of composers to write music for me, and I feel like they have been able to do their best work, and I've been able to do my best work because we understand each other, because of my musical background. And one thing I had to tell my dancers is when composers and musicians are in the room and working with us, don't talk to them. Let me be the arbiter.
You're the translator.
That part's too fast, or this part's too slow, or whatever.
Right.
That does not work.
Right.
But if you can have a respectful dialogue with a composer and musicians, and, you know, because musicians do not want to replicate the recording. They don't want to hear that you've been, rehearsing with this version of, you know, the Mozart Serenade, and then you're going to expect them to reproduce that point by point.
Exactly.
Because if you do, then why did you have them come in anyway?
Right. Right. So you could just press play if that's
right.
What you were going for. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
There are certain things that you want to have pre-recorded, but if you're going to have actual musicians in the room, that's where the driver's seat is.
Use them and allow them to breathe and allow them to, you know, to have their say. On the other hand, we went to Budapest and we performed there a piece that we had been performing before, but this was with a new singer and a new tabla player. It was Rabindranath Tagore songs. And
for
Tagore,
Jonathan, everything you say, I'm like, for real? You're like, yes, again, for real.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Well, Tagore was the first Nobel laureate from Asia, you know, and people lined up around the block to listen to him orate his poetry in Carnegie Hall. So there was a time when he was, you know, everybody knew his name. That is not the time we're living in. However, I was lucky to be in Calcutta and go to a dinner party, and the daughter of the host of the dinner party, the host said, "Would you like to hear my daughter sing?" And we're like, "Of course." And she sang some songs, and one of my dancers, one of my most musical dancers, burst into tears because it was just so exquisite, so pure, so beautiful. And I said, "Well, who wrote this?" Tagore. I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. Tagore, the freedom fighter, Tagore, who wrote the national anthem for India and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. I mean, you know, Tagore, the poet that Yeats idolized, the you know,
yeah.
Yeah, he wrote this. oh, well, how many songs did he write? Thousands. And I'm like, wait, this
wait,
is
we
impossible.
Didn't even know. This is news to me. He's so then, known as the poet.
So my original story about Budapest was we arrived in Budapest and this classical Tagore singer who was the closest to Budapest was in Paris. So she came over and she'd heard our recordings and she was going to accompany us with a tabla player. Well, unfortunately, in the performance, she closed her eyes because she got into so much of the spirit of it. And I remember this one dancer who's Ariel Bonilla from Mexico, who was just here recently, was dancing this solo and she closed her eyes, the singer, and went into this special place of reverie. And she sang the song at like half tempo. And Ariel was left to like improvise like double the amount of material than was in the choreography because there was no way to move as slowly as she was singing. But anyway, so that was funny.
Well, that's
that fun.
A perfect segue, Jonathan, because you touched on three things that I want to touch on. One, the music moved you, but when you see, let's start with this. When you see something amazing in dance and it just goes, like, again, we're both musicians, so when someone plays an amazing piano piece at lightning speed, but it's still tasteful and they're not a machine about it,
yeah.
You know, I noticed that, you know, it's the difference between like Jimi Hendrix solo and like an Yngwie Malmsteen or Joe Satriani or Steve Vai solo, which are just mechanisms. They're Jimi Hendrix is slide, breathe. And these guys are just 64th notes, right?
Okay. I don't know the other three, but I know what you're talking about with Jimi Hendrix. I mean, it was absolute, you know, heart and soul.
But not...
And technique at the same time, but not to show it
exactly.
off.
Exactly. So the guys, the metal guys I'm talking about are just show-offs,
okay.
Right? Literally, like, they play 128
and
notes.
There's a version of that in dance also. Look, I can jump higher. Look, I can do more turns. Look, I can
yes.
kick my leg.
Tell me about
and
that.
Hit my forehead.
Where's the one where you see that's Hendrix and that's just not the technically proficient? What, like, sort of, I don't even know how to describe it.
Let me talk about the great ballerina Margot Fonteyn. Margot Fonteyn was a dancer who entranced people, entranced the audience. And, you know, of course, there's the whole story of Nureyev defecting and partnering her, much, much older woman, younger man, but forming this amazing, amazing partnership. And looking at Fonteyn's performance, she did not lift her leg up to the ceiling. She did not do anything that looked flashy. Everything was done with such utter elegance and musicality and charisma and charm. And like, you can't even, but today it's like whack, you know, there's a lot of gymnastics that have come into ballet. This is kind of the opposite. And of course it's exciting because it's circus. And circus is exciting to see that the human body can do some of these things. So where is that happy medium that we say this is?
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Art.
Right. What do
we
you
don't need
see?
To deconstruct this.
Give us the primer as I am. I dated a girl who was a ballerina, right? And we went to a couple dance performances at Lincoln Center, and they were the best naps I've ever had because I just couldn't.
That's so interesting.
I know. I don't get it.
I can't.
I want to know.
What music was playing? Because you're a musician. So was it Stravinsky? Was it Tchaikovsky? Was it?
I think it was Tchaikovsky.
Was it good music?
I think it was Tchaikovsky, which sort of bores me to death anyway.
Okay. All right. So maybe she picked the wrong program.
Yeah. And I loved it for the first couple minutes, and then I just couldn't. I want to love this, and I want to know. Give us a primer. Give me a primer, and therefore give our listeners a primer on what are we looking for? What's the thing that just, like, when Jonathan goes, boom, that's it. This is my top five.
I saw a performance on Monday night that was the opening of an Indian dance festival called Drive East, and the dancer was Bijayani Satpati. And this was her first solo performance, separating from a group that she's been with for decades that New York has, you know, idolized, called Nrityagram, in a small village in India where an actress dancer named Protima Bedi established a dance village and had the idea that, you know, to have a incubator. And this Bijayani was one of the two. Sarupa Sen is her dance partner, and everything they did was together. So she broke away and gave her breakout solo concert on Monday night. The entire audience was holding its breath. We felt shivers up and down our arms. Baryshnikov was one seat away from me.
Oh!
And he was the first one to jump up for the standing ovation that went on for like 90 seconds. I mean, a minute and a half for a solo Indian classical dance performance in New York. You know, it was kind of remarkable. What was it about her performance?
Yes, what was it? What gave you those shivers?
Let's start from the fact that she's a beautiful, beautiful woman. So you like to look at her. And not just beauty off of Vogue magazine, but beauty in a dance way, meaning large eyes that are so expressive that in the slightest change of her expression, you could see clouds in the sky. You could see, a vulture being attacked by a god that cut off his wing. You know, the stories could come through her face.
Wow, there's another aspect of dance that I don't look at, and I have to look at. You're also acting.
Yes. That was the thing. It was the consummate dance actress going on there. And so even if you didn't know anything about Indian dance and had no background at it at all, she could hold your attention. And on the physical level, there were gestures where she would go up into a diagonal, like lift up and go down to the floor in, like, it was like water. It was so fluid. It was as if there were no bones in her body, but the ultimate control that could allow that to happen. So technique, but the technique is all underneath. All you see is the art that has been built on this architecture of technique.
Jonathan, you're making it really hard because what you're saying right here is you know it when you see it.
That's true.
But
I agree. I agree with that. I didn't study Indian dance.
Right?
I went to India as a 16-year-old. I started looking at Indian dance and listening to Indian music. It took me a long time. Indian music, for a classically Western-trained musician, hits the ear in a strange way.
But you understand immediately. Everyone's like, is this all improvised? I'm like, no, this is completely written, and it's all based upon very established scales.
The raga.
Yes,
right.
You understand that. I think actually, as a classical musician, Indian music is more accessible to me than jazz would be.
Well, that's
I love jazz.
Uh-huh.
Just ask me to play jazz, I'd be like, bink, bink, bonk, bonk. That would be it. Like, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Jazz, I have learned to appreciate jazz from the inside through a composer named Frank Carlberg, who's based in Brooklyn, teaches at the New England Conservatory and Berkeley in Boston. And he was trained in Helsinki, which has, you know, the music in Finland is
yes.
like a really high level.
Oh, especially the black metal.
I was thinking of opera and violin and conducting. I was thinking Finnish death metal. Okay. Well, you know, the different sides. But he became a jazz pianist and composer. And when we started to work together collaboratively, I had to understand how much would be structured and how much would be free, mm-hmm. and how to have enough underpinning that the dancers could connect to if, in fact, in the live performance there was going to be improvisation.
Right.
Where was the, you know, the structure that the dancers would know would always be there? And it, you know...
16-bar breaks.
I learned from Frank.
Yeah.
I learned that the performance that's unwritten is always better than the one that is completely written out jazz-wise.
And also that unwritten part is still structured because you have the rhythm section keeping to the chart and moving through that. And also, you've got an allotted amount of time. You've got a 16 or a 32-bar break where you take your solos, so at least your dancers know then with the jazz tune, there's the head, and there's the head at the end, but we know exactly how much time in the middle to let yourself free.
But we also know that Bach improvised
his
fugues.
Like, yeah.
I mean, that's hard to wrap your mind around. I mean, it's we all know it theoretically, but to understand that he could sit down at the keyboard and actually play the Art of Fugue, like, you know, as an improvisation.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's that scene from Amadeus where Salieri goes, he plays that one tune, and Mozart goes, he's like, bong, ka-ka-ka-dung, bong, gong, this doesn't really work, does it? And then he rewrites the whole thing. He's like, wouldn't this be better?
Yeah.
Yes, Beethoven, genius. Bach, Mozart, they were all improvisers. They were jazz.
But when you think about it, how do you, like, dance and music our improvisation, even if it doesn't end up being that, because somebody is in the dance studio improvising. How did they
until
create,
they get it
until they set it
right?
Like Twyla Tharp is a perfect example, and she's the first choreographer that I had the opportunity to work with in New York.
Oh my God, Jonathan again! Twyla Tharp, John Cage, Rauschenberg.
Well, I was privileged. I was blessed. I really was.
You really were. And it's really exciting for me.
I was not the great dancer. And that's really, really important to know that this is not that I came in fully ready to be at the highest level of what Twyla could do. No. I just happened to be 6 foot tall and musical. And musicality is number one for Twyla. She's brilliantly musical. Anyone who works with her has to be incredibly musical. So, but she would go into her studio, improvise, and was one of the early people to actually video everything that she did. But she also had human videos. She had Sarah Rudner and Rosemary Wright were her sort of human memorizers, because they had this incredible ability to pick up the most complex things that Twyla was doing,
and they recorded it
in their bodies,
and
they could then teach it to the next level.
Okay, that was. There were like 14 questions before that I already forgot, because now I'm on the next one, which is, we have notation in music.
Yeah, right.
What is dance notation?
Is there? Yes.
Tell me about that. I have no idea what it is.
Well, it's called laba notation, and it is a written form of movement that that somebody could, a reader who was trained in laba notation, could reconstruct.
What's it look like?
It's on paper. It's stick figures.
Really?
Yeah. So this angle means such and such a gesture, and this angle means something. And it's nowadays.
But what about the subtleties? Do you have filigrees and trills and grace notes and all those things that we have in written notation of music?
I think it all can be there depending on the notator and how much detail they put into it. But of course, since the age of smartphones and readily accessible cameras, it's normally combined with video. And it's also normally combined, and this is essential, with the dancers who originally danced it, because they will say, no, Balanchine intended this. And Balanchine changed it because that dancer was better at this than that. I mean, like, they bring in the nuance and the detail and the history of the making of that dance.
Wow, so you rewrite dance per who your ensemble is.
You can, and you
because you actually would never do that with. Let's go back to. We keep going back to music. This is why these are intrinsically linked. You would never rewrite a sonata and say you can't play that well. I'm going to rewrite it different for you because you've got. I wrote a 13th reach, right? And you can't do a 13th. So I'm going to rewrite it to a 12th. I'm like, no, that's just an octave and that doesn't make sense. But you could rewrite dance for a particular dancer.
I think that when a choreographer is alive and has different generations of dancers, they do change. I mean, it's classic that it's known that Balanchine changed certain of his pieces, and critics were angry sometimes because they said it didn't end the way it used to, or, you know,
oh my God,
what happened to that? And if you follow Facebook, there's a dancer who danced with Balanchine for years named John Clifford, and he's based in Los Angeles, and he actually created the LA Ballet that lasted for a certain number of years. But he's constantly commenting on, he finds archival footage of performances of Balanchine's works, and he says, now today they left that out, or today they've done this and they really should go back to that. So, you know, if you're interested in these things, and I am, it's because I saw the performances in the 70s, and I saw Violette Verdi, and I saw Patricia McBride, and I saw these Edward Villella, these incredible dancers. And then, you know, you go back and see a piece 30 years later and you might be disappointed because something's missing or not. You know, sometimes you go and you're like, these dancers are out of this world. I mean, you know, how can they do this? So I don't know how to say it, but just to say,
you're saying it great.
Well, dance is a living art form.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that's cliche is that it's ephemeral. It's, you know, you see it and then it's gone. It only lives on in your memory.
Which is a great experience. And today, where everything is shared and permanent, dance is ephemeral, and there is something about that. Like, again, we keep going back to music, but you can buy a recording. You can buy 30 recordings of the same string quartet and hear it 44 different times.
Right, and people do.
But you can only see that one dance performance once, and there it is.
Right, the one I was talking about on Monday night with Bijayani. I mean, there was something about this as a breakout moment in her career.
And you're collectively in it with everyone else. Even though she's the one doing it, it's actually sort of not about her. It's about everyone in the room.
And everybody knew that this was a big moment for her.
Baryshnikov!
Yeah.
My God. This is
very, very, you know, in his shorts and in a Czech shirt like yours. And, you know, he does not invite attention. Let's put it that way. He really, really does not want attention. But
everyone, it's one of those, there he is. But yeah. No one says it out loud.
Yeah. Except the people who do. And then he's like, his night is ruined.
Listen, you don't do that. I was at a bar once and I was sitting as close as I am to you. And right behind me, apparently the entire time, was Bruce Willis. And then I went to the bathroom.
I hope you didn't get into a fight.
No, I went to the bathroom. We paid the bill and me and my friends walked out. And my friends go, that was wild. Bruce Willis was right next to us. And I go, where was he? They go, literally behind your back, because I was the one facing towards everyone, right? And apparently when I was in the bathroom, someone goes up and goes, I love your work. Can I buy you a drink? He goes, buddy, I can afford my own drinks. Move on. Baryshnikov is like, I know. Just chill out.
Yes, somebody came up to him and said, are you Mikhail Baryshnikov? And he goes, yeah.
All right, we went off on a tangent.
Way off.
But an entertaining tangent.
Celebrity sightings in Tribeca. We can go on that.
Oh,
one.
My God. Yeah, well, that's the thing. That's why Tribeca, we are in. We are we're Tribeca adjacent right now, I guess. We're sort of
we're in Tribeca East.
We're in Chinatown-ish. Yeah,
we're in Chinatown Tribeca, where the city is about to destroy this community by putting up a 45-story jail, so that a jail will become.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait, this they're replacing that one.
Yeah, they're going to tear that down, which was built at the. You know, against the community's wishes in Chinatown, and with a senior center connected to it, with more 100-year-old people than anywhere else in the United States, and they're going to build a 45-story jail, destroying Columbus Park, which is the most used park in our neighborhood.
In the United States.
Where senior Chinese
I did not know anything about this. This has not been publicized.
This is the brilliant borough-based jail project. Close Rikers.
Yes.
The hysteria about Close Rikers. How about fix Rikers? How about tomorrow at Rikers?
How about stop jailing people?
Retrain these abusive, you know, whatever. I can't even
All right. You and I are going to stop this. We're going to talk about this because I want to act on this. But for the rest of you non-New Yorkers, back to dance.
Let's talk about dance as a community thing. Like, this is why Battery...
Yeah, talk about Battery, because you are a Southern New York pioneer. Because for those of you who don't know New York history, well, New York for 200 years of existence was the tip of New York.
Right.
So all the cultural institutions were down here. The opera was founded down here. Columbia University, King's College then, was founded down here. But as Manhattan grew up the island, all those cultural institutions moved up. Madison Square Garden has moved 4 different times to where it is now. It was in Madison Square Park. That's why it was called Madison Square Garden. It's now nowhere near Madison Square Garden, but all these things. And Broadway was the Gold Coast, and that's where all the opera houses and theater companies were. And guess where they moved? They moved to Broadway,
but
except 42nd Street Broadway.
Don't forget about Castle Clinton, which was Castle Garden, where Jenny Lind performed.
Exactly. But what I'm saying to our listeners is all those things left Southern Manhattan. And then here...
You're the first person who's brought that out in any interview of me since 1976, so thank you.
Well, because I'm a New York scholar. This is my hometown. This is what I love. I love New York history. I've read 300 books on New York City history, right?
Fantastic.
And we have this evolution where it went from Broadway down here by Wall Street to 14th Street, to 5th Avenue, to the Upper East Side. That's where the rich and the cultural institutions moved. And then we've got the death of Lower Manhattan from basically, let's say, 1950 to 1990, right?
By death, I guess you mean death by money? Death by skyscrapers?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
A dearth of... No one lived here.
Yeah.
No one lived in this neighborhood.
Right, and I did.
And
I
you
lived
did.
On Stone Street, which is the first paved street in Manhattan.
Wait, you lived on Stone Street?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You couldn't live on Stone Street right now because it's Mardi Gras there.
No, but
every
Stone
day of the week.
Stone Street was the back door of these little restaurants where, you know, people dumped their trash and rats had a field day. But that's where my first loft was located. I had 3,000 square feet of wooden floor exposure on 4 sides. And that's where, that was my learning laboratory. Those early days, 8 years on Stone Street.
Oh my God. For those of you who are not New Yorkers, Stone Street is a carnival right now. It is closed to traffic. It is cobblestoned and it's just full of banquet tables because every bar and restaurant 24/7 365 now, it's basically a festival market every
right,
single
it's
day.
It's like an Oktoberfest 12 months.
Oktoberfest, perfect. Yeah, thank you. Let's talk about Battery Dance and how important it is or was and still is to come here to basically a cultural desert, because it was like that in the 70s.
Well, you know what happened to us is that Soho was already packed and Midtown was out of range. We had no money, basically.
There we go.
And we found 3,000 square foot of raw wood space. We built out a space where we could live and work. And the fact is that we couldn't afford anything else. And that was like, nobody wanted that because it was in a very old building on Stone Street.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't in, you know, the 44-story skyscraper next door.
All right.
So the first thing we did was to go bring our dances that we worked on, you know, in the studio. Where can we perform them? Well, there are no theaters here, so let's perform them out of doors. And we performed at a place called Jeanette Park. As a historian, you might know that became Vietnam Veterans Park.
Oh, okay. Yes, now I do know. Yeah.
At the time, it was called Jeanette Park. God knows why. And 55 Water Street, this huge buildings with all kinds of business in them. And we brought a brass quintet and dancers and 7.5 tons of Carrara marble sculptures. And we populated the park with art for a short time. And what happened was thousands of people came out and watched us at lunchtime.
Downtown.
Downtown.
Right, because
Water Street.
We're in.
You can't get farther south than
No. You're next to the terminal, right?
Right.
And this is in 1976?
Yes.
So this is, everyone is straight commuters at this point in time.
Right. You come to Wall Street. By all the briefcases going into the Wall Street subway.
Exactly. But you come in. And then you go out.
Yes.
Now, I mean, and by the way, this is not in our lifetime, our recent memory. Now, can you live down there? And there are shops and everything like that. Blah blah blah.
These buildings have been converted into
residential. All the offices are now residential.
I'm wondering where do they work because there's so much residential.
I don't know. This is brand new to me too because you know I had friends I'd house sit down on like John Street and stuff. I'd be like I'd struggle to find a place to get a drink after 10 o'clock.
We couldn't find In fact, that's a story because we had to go to Chinatown to do laundry because we didn't have machines
anywhere near you
and there wasn't a place to go and also no restaurants that weren't like for bankers that were
close at 4:30.
Well, they might be open but they were watering holes for stockbrokers.
I'm not gonna order from Delmonico's every day of the week
or Michael's so we would walk to Chinatown and that became a saving moment for us because after 8 years in our space we were faced with eviction. The rent was going to skyrocket, whatever. And we were in desperate condition because we lived there and worked there. And so everything was there. And moving, trying to find space at whatever we could pay, which was $5, $6, $7 a square foot.
Right.
People would laugh. Well, we found a real estate agency in Chinatown that we had passed on the way to look for laundry and restaurants and so forth, and went into that real estate agency, which doesn't exist anymore. And there was a woman who knew the owner of this building, 380 Broadway, that we're in now on White Street and Broadway. And she said, well, some friends of mine own this building. They haven't rented it out. They have a furniture store on the ground floor. Let's go take a look at it. And we came on a very gray, cold December morning.
And you saw it at its worst.
We went into the freight elevator, which was a cranked elevator, not what you see now.
Yep.
And we cranked. And as we're going up, we're looking at the side view of the building and we're seeing that there's wooden floors. And that was...
Boom, done. This is what we need.
But we didn't want our faces to reveal that we were excited. So we get up to the fifth floor and we see an expanse of 185 feet uninterrupted and width of 30 feet. No pillars because we're on the top floor. So we found the bonanza, which is really funny because Glamour Furniture on the ground floor always was advertising living room bonanza,
And you found the dance bonanza.
We did, except that the floor, you couldn't walk across the floor because it was bowed up from all of the rain that had been basically raining in from the ceiling. So we had to do major reconstruction while in production, while touring, and without any money. So literally all of our dancers,
again, community, volunteer, everyone's getting together.
That's the whole spirit of this dance company. It hasn't really changed in all of these years.
And let's talk about your festival, your upcoming festival. When is it and what is it and how can people come to it?
Well, it's the natural outgrowth of that first performance at Jeanette Park when we realized people want to see this, put it out there, let them see this. Don't make them come to a black box theater where they have to pay money and go to see a dance company that they never heard of. So our festival is across the boards in terms of genre. It goes from August 11th to August 17th. We have 6 nights out at Wagner Park, free to the public, and we get audiences of 1,500 to 2,000 people every night.
Amazing.
And every night is made up of a mélange of different genres. So you might not like one piece, and the next piece is going to be like, oh my God, that's the best thing I ever saw. Who was that? I want to follow them. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. We have companies, 10 companies coming from overseas, India, Curacao, Austria, Switzerland, Lithuania, France. I mean, it's very,
it all
very
sounds
exciting.
Great except for the French.
Oh,
no, I'm joking.
That's so mean. Wait, Ravel, Debussy, let me bring you back. Poulet.
Okay, you're right. I love me some Debussy. Ravel, the master orchestrator. He could do miracles with an orchestra.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm back in. Yeah. You know what? France, you're back to cool again. You weren't for about 14 seconds, but now you're cool.
Jonathan the Francophile was there to save the day.
Francophile, Indiophile. What are you not a file of?
Well, we've been in, Battery Dance has been in 70 countries around the world.
That is amazing.
You know, every time we go to a new country, Honduras this year, Bangladesh coming up. I mean, we fall
in love.
Also
community because these are not
whistle stop tours.
No, exactly.
Either. We don't go do a performance and helicopter
leave.
Out. We interact with young people.
And you learn their dance traditions and yada, yada, yada.
We teach them what we talked about at the front of our interview, uh-huh. which is that everyone is a dancer. So anyone can participate in our Dancing to Connect workshops, at the end of which a performance is done where young people present works that they own, that they created on their own. And this could be a cross-border program like Israelis,
right.
Catholics and Protestants in Belfast.
I mean, Honduras and Nicaragua and El Salvador were in civil wars with one another forever, blah, blah, blah.
But
let's put it together.
We
yeah.
were in Honduras in San Pedro Sula, which the New York Times called the most violent city in the world that's not in a conflict zone. I mean, there's no war going on there, there's war going on
from
there.
Indigenous
the
displacement, drug cartels, yada,
yes.
yada. Yeah. Why do I keep saying yada, yada, yada?
I don't know.
No, I guess I was going to say because I'm south of Canal, but but Jerry Seinfeld lived on the Upper West Side, so I don't think yada, yada, yada
Did
makes sense.
Did he create that?
What?
Did Jerry
Oh, yeah, yada, yada, yada is from Seinfeld,
oh
and it's
God.
Also TV Guide's number one catchphrase of the 20th century.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's
because you
well,
just
amazing
like,
and awesome. Yeah. We have to get rid of those words and find some new ones. Can you give me some new ones?
Splendiferous.
So back to the festival.
Yes, please.
Come one, come all. The 11th through the 16th at Wagner Park from 7 p.m., you see the sunset, you see the sky, you see the wonderful Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island as you're seeing these beautiful dancers across the stage two hours every night. And then on the 17th, there's a final performance at Schimmel Center. And for the first year ever...
Where's Schimmel Center?
Schimmel Center is in Pace University, so it's opposite
City
Hall.
Oh, got it. Right next to the bridge.
Yeah. It's about 700 seats, and we fill it, you know, for this finale. And we always need to have one indoor performance in case, God forbid, there's rain.
Right.
And we bring somebody from Sri Lanka, and they get rained out. So we need to have a fallback indoors.
Got
it. A roof over our heads.
Got it.
Yeah.
This is
the Battery Dance Festival, 38th year, by the way. Longest running public dance festival in New York.
It's almost as old as Maria. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been absolutely spectacular. We're going to do this again because we need to know more. Let's go into the mechanics of dance next time. But first, this was awesome as a primer. This is Jonathan Hollander, the director of Battery Dance. And this, I will post this on Saturday.
Wow,
so everyone, we're doing this right away. So
Saturday's, Sunday, we open
Saturday's
on Sunday.
Tomorrow. So yeah. This Sunday, if you're listening to this on Saturday, come downtown to Wagner Park. And
Battery Park City.
Engage
just north of Battery Park.
Exactly. And engage in
the Battery Dance
38th year festival.
Yeah. Opening with Sri Lanka, with Iraq, with Romania, with New York. We got everything on board for that.
Jonathan Hollander, this has been absolutely fascinating, and I cannot wait to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Good night, everyone.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.